You are listening to Hearing Voices from NPR. This next hour is about how we handle the process of death and dying. I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices with stories from people who are close to people who are close to death. Here's producer Jake Warga.
It takes 4 seconds after jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge to hit the ocean 220 feet below. A year ago, my friend Phil was riding his bicycle over the bridge. About mid-span, he stopped, took off his helmet, and jumped to his death. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000. Phil was 33 years old. We're the same age. 1-1000. I first met Phil 4 years ago when he called to tell me his brother Brian, my good friend from college, had killed himself. Brian was 32 when he injected a lethal dose of morphine. Standing in Brian's room where he killed himself, the odor of death unmistakable and horrible, Phil and I started the task of cleaning. Phil lost a brother, and I lost a friend that day. We filled the void with each other. Soon we were signing our emails, bro. When Phil's girlfriend called me, crying, I knew. Part of me hoped it was a bike accident, that he was just hurt, that all this ended with Brian. Their mother killed herself when they were toddlers. Unlike his brother, Phil didn't leave any notes, or hints he was even thinking about killing himself. He was planning on visiting me in 1 month. I saved his message.
Jake, it's Phil. Trying to warn you that Sarah and I are going to, like, come up for a visit. Anyway, let me know how that sits with you. I'll talk to you. Goodbye.
2-1000. I held Phil's hand in the morgue. He was so cold. I stared at his sleeping eyes and bruised face, wondering, why? Soon I began to see Brian's face, then my father's. The dead all have a way of showing up at once. After getting Phil's backpack from the coroner's in a dripping shopping bag, we spread the contents out to dry back at his apartment. Nothing. No note. No clue. He filled out an absentee ballot, but it was too ruined to mail. We found his van parked in the Presidio, just up from the Golden Gate Bridge, where he usually left it to go biking. This is the CD that was playing when we started the engine. It's a British group called The Stars. It was a music mix I made for him. Numbs the pain, sends you gently for the fall. 3-1000. After leaving Phil at the morgue, I walked out onto the Golden Gate Bridge and sat down mid-span away from the bikers and joggers. It looks peaceful and majestic on postcards, but it's a really noisy place. It's a highway, the 101. It's hard not to jump. The railing is only 4 feet high. The original plans had it at 5.5 feet. One theory for the difference is that the chief engineer of the bridge, Joseph Strauss, was only 5 foot tall, and he wanted to see over the rail. Maybe because it's named after the sunset, it's the world's most popular suicide destination. Since it opened in 1937, over 1,300 people have jumped, a lot more if you count those who may have jumped at night and disappeared with the tide. There's always talk of a barrier to prevent people from jumping. In 1977, a huge rally was staged, and a minister named Jim Jones said that the bridge is, quote, a symbol of human ingenuity, technological genius, but a social failure. Later, he left the Bay Area and moved to Jonestown, Guyana. The color of the bridge is orange vermilion, international orange. It's the same color as the carpet in the funeral home and the church where they had Phil's service. It reminds me of the color of dried blood. 4-1000. When you hit the water, it's at 75 miles per hour, 15,000 pounds per square inch. The only way to survive is to hit feet first at a slight angle. Otherwise, you go straight down and drown. Very few have survived the jump.
And I keep saying to myself, don't jump, don't jump, don't jump. It's a bad idea. You'll die. There's no coming back from this.
John Kevin Hines was 18 when he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge in 2000 and survived. I thought maybe he would have the answer, or at least some insight into why Phil jumped.
And I said to myself, if one person says, are you okay, I won't do it. And I'll spill my guts and I'll tell them everything that's going on in my head. But if nobody says anything, I'm going to jump. So I stood there, and that's when the woman came up to me, and I thought, okay, great. She's going to ask me if I'm okay. I'll tell her everything. She'll call somebody. Everything's going to be fine. She comes out and goes, and like, I think it was a German accent. She was like, will you take my picture? I'm a nice guy. I was like, all right, yeah, sure, no problem. And I wiped the tears off my eyes. She didn't even notice. So I took her picture, gave her a camera back. She walked away. I turned around. I cursed at the world, literally. And I said, nobody cares. And I jumped. Second, I was on free fall. I said, I want to die. This is ridiculous. I was falling head first. I somehow got feet first. I hit the water. So I swam to the surface, not knowing where exactly it was, but I just swam to the light. Well, I was lucky that the Coast Guard was already right near me.
I wanted to hear Phil and Kevin, hear him say that he would never try to kill himself again, apologize for hurting us. I imagined Kevin's words to be Phil's and Brian's.
You know what? I got to tell you that I'm very happy right now. I got two arms, two legs, and I'm awake. I didn't die today, and I didn't die that day. I'm a very blessed and lucky man. I will never attempt again. Never.
Phil was a pathologist. He was a brilliant doctor. He could look at a biopsy slide under the microscope and tell you how you're going to die, see into the secrets of life from just a few cells. I asked him once, what is life? This is Phil.
Tell you what. What do you want to know? Life as I see it under the microscope? It's a big mix of goo.
My recorder broke about a minute into the interview. It's the only tape I have of him. The more I chase death, the more I choke on the only thing it leaves in its wake, questions. I was nowhere closer to understanding why Phil jumped, and I was closer to realizing that there might not be any meaning. I needed a break, so my best friend Jen and I went down the coast to Monterey for a night. It was late, midnight. We were walking on a small beach in front of the hotel. I was so tired and haven't felt alive for a long time now. Then bang! I broke into a sprint right out into the darkness. I ran as fast and frustrated as I could. When I came to the black water, I didn't stop. Kicking up spray, I entered the ocean, fully clothed. When I got a little deeper than my knees, I leapt high, almost out of the water, spinning, landing hard on my back. Oh my God, what the hell are you? Were the last words I heard before I plunged into absolute salty silence and freezing darkness. 1/1000. It was cold, really cold. Everything stopped. Jen, waves, breathing, feeling, gone, all gone. I was weightless. The life seemed to have gone right out of me, lingering on the surface. 2/1000. The water tasted saltier than I remembered as a kid growing up in Southern California. I felt at peace. 3/1000. More memories came to me, faces of those no longer living. My childhood dog, Charlie, my grandparents, my parents, Brian, Phil. I tried, but you can't cry underwater. The ocean is already one enormous tear. 4/1000. The numbing cold now burned. I started to feel pain, the surest sign of life. I righted myself and broke through the surface, gasping for air. I struggled to walk to the shore, paddling with my arms against the undertow. Jen made me pose for a photo. I shivered as she fiddled with the camera, waiting for the flash to warm up. Everything I was wearing hung off me as if I were a child in adult clothes. In the photo, I'm smiling, because that's how I feel. Alive. A little less than a happy high. A little less than a suicide. The only things that you really try. This is not my life. It's just a fond farewell to a friend. It's not what I'm like. It's just a fond farewell to a friend. Things right. Fond farewell to a friend. This is not my life. It's just a fond farewell to a friend.
Four Seconds, produced by Jake Warga in 2005. You are hearing voices close to death. Here's something from the late 70s, NPR's Josh Darsa talking to the man with the white cane.
At 6 o'clock, the rush hour in Chicago's subways is at its peak. At the Clark and Division Street station, it is particularly heavy. People are anxious to get home from work. The trains at that time are frequent. The rush to get on them is so rapid that one can get lost from the human mass around him. This is the story of one man who did.
I'm a piano tuner in private practice. I was traveling home from a restaurant on Wellington and Clark Street called Ivanhoe Restaurant, where I had tuned the piano. And I boarded the bus at about 5:30 and rode as far as Clark and Division. Then I went downstairs and entered the subway.
Herman Porter, 75 years of age. Despite his years, Herman Porter is not unaccustomed to keeping up with the people around him. He also is a man who is sure of himself. And on this particular evening, he was certain of what he was doing and how he was going about it.
I knew the subway station. I knew just exactly how to enter it and how to go through. There's three flights of stairs that goes down from the ticket window. I wanted to be towards the back end of the train because when I would get off at Ashland and 63rd, I would be near the stairs, and that way I could be able to find the little red box where you punch your transfer and be able to go down and make better time. So there are two trains that in the subway. They come from Howard Street, and one is an A train and one is a B train. And the B train does not stop at this particular station, but the A train does. So the A train is one that takes me where I want to go.
It is not Herman Porter's age that makes people wonder about him. Age is not necessarily an obstacle to keeping up. Herman Porter has even run on occasion when he is in a hurry. People do pay attention to this. Herman Porter takes no notice. His view of the world is different from theirs. He has no view of the world. Herman Porter is blind.
The B train came by after about 4 or 5 minutes. It sped on through, and about another 4 or 5 minutes, the A train came. And most of the cars passed me. And then when I heard the A train, I walked about 3 or 4 feet in front of me and touched the train with my cane and felt along the train with my cane. And I, "Is there anybody around?" I said. I was kind of anxious to get in that train.
90 tons of steel and electricity flash out of the tunnel and into the Clark and Division Street station about every 5 minutes during the rush hour. Herman Porter's handicap on this night was not his blindness. He knew his way both in the subway station and in crowds. His problem that evening was that he was in a hurry, and so was everybody else.
Nobody seemed to respond, so I felt along and I found an opening. And I carry my tools, which weigh about 20 pounds. So I put my cane down, and there was no floor. But my tools, the weight of my tools, unbalanced me so that I pitched forward into the opening and went straight down.
No one in that awful moment saw Herman Porter plunge forward. He lay in the semi-darkness under the platform, and in the total darkness of his own private world. Herman Porter estimates he had at least 30 seconds to decide what to do, how to position himself. We average the trains during their stops at the Clark and Division Street station during the rush hour. Herman Porter had about 11 seconds to decide.
Then exactly what happened, I don't precisely know, because when I went down, I knew that I had to go all the way down because evidently nobody had seen me. I was very frightened, and I hollered as loud as I could. And then I thought, well, I'll flatten myself out. And I turned myself over in such a way that my face was facing the wall of the platform underneath. And then I laid there, and the train proceeded to move over me.
It is difficult to imagine how any of us would have reacted in Herman Porter's place. It is impossible for most of us, given his additional handicap. Herman Porter had fractions to decide how to place his body without any part of a moving train touching him. A fast-acting person could conceivably save himself, having seen the positions of the platform, tracks, and wheels many times before. But Herman Porter, although familiar with the train station, had never seen any part of it.
I had some hopes that I could escape. If there's any way to escape, that I probably will escape. But if I don't escape, I guess it's just there's an eternity waiting for me. It seemed as though two coaches passed right over me. Those wheels are spinning around there, going by. I didn't feel the track on my back. If I felt the track on my back, the wheel would have got me. The wheel didn't touch me. Couldn't touch me. If it touched me, I would have been gone, or it might have finished me off.
All this time, the old man still clutched his trusty white cane. Normally, 41 inches of life support. On this evening, a possible peril. But Herman Porter, even in those 11 seconds of decision, had kept his cane, his cool, and his life.
I laid there still till there were no more coaches. And then I raised my cane up in the air because I still had my cane in my hand. I raised it up in the air and I hollered, and there were three gentlemen came. And they pulled me up by the shoulder and set me up against the wall. And I said, "Don't take my cane away from me, because that's something I would just want for moral support of anything else."
Finally, someone had noticed Herman Porter. Gently, he was lifted to the platform. He was too weak to stand and too sore to sit. Others had phoned for emergency assistance. Herman Porter's rush hour ordeal was almost over.
Then they called the officers, a fire department, I guess it was, and they came down and they tried to lift me, and I said, "Don't lift me, because I don't know how bad I'm hurt." So they took a board and put me on a board, and they took the board and they carried, lifted me on the board, and that way they slid me off the board onto the stretcher and then carried me upstairs.
Herman Porter was taken to a waiting ambulance from nearby Henrotten Hospital. Examination showed he had a fractured hip, a sore shoulder, and a bump on the head, all probably caused by his fall from the platform. He is now convalescing and reflecting.
I have a faith that I believe that if in a day of trouble and you call on the Lord, then he'll help you. And that's my belief. And I did get helped, so I'm here to tell it.
When he tells it, Herman Porter does not show very much emotion in recounting his ordeal, nor did we ask him about his emotions during those 11 crucial seconds next to the wheels of the A train. Only his thoughts. Whatever emotions he may have felt while his mind was reacting to his predicament will remain private. Emotions are a very private ordeal for the blind. This is Josh Darcy.
My grandmother broke her hip. "It's fairly common," the young doctor assures me over the telephone. "After all, she's 89 years old this month. They will replace the joint with an artificial one, so she can be up on a walker within a week or two. I'm the favorite granddaughter, and so I drive the 100 miles I have driven so many times out Highway 66, west towards the silhouette of the Blue Ridge, where they sell apple cider, pumpkins, and bushels of still delicious last of summer peaches. And I find her, as I always do, in her homemade cotton nightgown, that she saves for special occasions, reading a Baptist newsletter. Her pretty white hair is all fluffed out, and someone has put a little pink lipstick on her. She says she's fine, really fine, except for some, what do you call them? Hallucinations? Some little boys come in here, she says. I knew they weren't real, but I let them stay. One of them was singing a hymn, and the other one was playing a little fiddle kind of thing. But when I heard the nurse coming, I told them they'd better go away, and they did. She tells me this story as calmly as she has told me all the other amazing stories over the years. Like the time she and her older sister Alice churned cream all day long on the porch while her mama was having Uncle Richard in the house. 7 pounds of butter we made that day. Mama says she never heard of anyone getting 7 pounds of butter out of one churning. I guess we just want something to keep our minds off of her yelling in the house. She's a real period piece, my grandmother. Born to a sharecropper in North Carolina and put to picking cotton before she was 12. She once picked 100 pounds, more than any of the men could pick, and gave the 50 cents she earned for it to her papa. She's a good storyteller, better than any of us, and I'm a good listener. But for both of us, it's better that we ignore the gray institutional tile floors, the pills and the medicine cups, the staring irrelevant television, and instead fill the room with pictures of her and her 7 sisters breaking watermelon on a rock by the creek and eating it with their bare hands after a long, hot morning working in the fields. Now, don't you worry about me, honey, she always says. I've had a good life. You just take care of them children. So on our way home, my son and I have red beans, coleslaw, and sliced tomatoes at a silver diner outside of Warrington. It wasn't as good as the Sunday evening leftovers she used to give me when we lived in that big white house on 38th Street, but it kept her memory with us for a few extra miles.
That was Carmen Dalzell. You also heard NPR's Josh Darsa and the man with the white cane. Part of life is death and dying. More of both coming up in a minute as we stay close to death on Hearing Voices.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
You are listening to Hearing Voices, and this week we're close to death. Here's Salt Lake City producer Scott Carrier with the death of Ruth Tuck.
The obituary reads Ruth Tuck, 65, died yesterday of a lingering illness at University Hospital. Born September 15, 1921, in Charleston, South Carolina, to Austin and Eunora Whitehurst. Married Wendell Tuck, April 7, 1947. They were later divorced. Ruth is survived by 2 daughters, Arlene Summers, Los Angeles, Margaret Simpson, Salt Lake City. She will be missed by all those who knew her.
My dear friends, we are gathered here today that we might fittingly recognize the end of a life upon this earth and to offer our gratitude to God for the presence among us of this beloved soul, Ruth Tuck. In these days of computerization, when it sometimes seems to us that life itself has become a number, and the facts of someone's life and death are known as vital statistics, let us remind ourselves that life is more than that which occurs between a date of a birth and a date of death, and that we are gathered here today to bear witness that there is yet another set of facts to be remembered, and that is that no life can be fully and adequately described by any measure of time, be it minutes, hours, or years. Now, I know that the details of Ruth's life are far better known to you, her family, than they are to me, and that I do not need to try to chronicle those details here today. Let me say that I believe Ruth has affected each of you, and certainly no accident of death can remove that influence or erase the memories of your mind.
Yes, well,
by saying that our purpose,
well, I don't want to make a headline type of thing out of this. I had driven into town especially to see Ruth. I had just walked into the hospital room, and I don't think she was really very well taken care of. I know that I didn't quite trust the nurses, and I used to be a nurse's aide myself, so, well, I don't want to sound prejudiced, but the care and attention and even the love that a truly sick person receives in a Catholic hospital is a whole world apart from some of the others I know. So, well, and then, of course, when I saw her, she was lying so still. And I thought first she was just staring in some sort of a unhappy or a dull mood. But then when I got closer to her, I noticed that her eyes were glassy. And then I reached out to touch her. And she was quite cold. Quite cold. And I was angered, terribly angered. Angered mostly because nobody had been there. Nobody had been with her, that Ruth had had to die alone.
Well, she came into the hospital with symptoms of lethargy and obtundation, couldn't think well, and inability to eat well, and had been sick in bed. And it suddenly began to pass blood in her in her stools. And She developed was admitted
severe complications from being so sick, and pus, problems like diffuse alveolar damage, which are
infections.
So she looked absolutely horrible.
Also, some renal failure.
An infection with a real
suggestion of an abscess,
bad kind of bacteria that's very hard to kill.
By a special scan of the brain, there was destroys them like an abscess in the brain too.
Staph aureus. Staph
became neurally impaired.
It's a bad kind of bacteria to get.
She got bruises all over her whole upper body.
Her kidneys finally shut down, and an unknown complication of
fluid and,
growing bacteria.
So she turned very green, and you knew her liver wasn't working
because their breath gets real bad.
But in combination with all her other problems, like
cytomegalovirus, pneumonias, pneumocystis carinii, cryptococcal meningitis, toxoplasmosis, brain abscesses, she just didn't do well.
Well, I didn't mind. I really didn't mind. I mean, yes, Rick has to work, and we have children, and especially when she got sicker and sicker and needed constant care, that was hard. But I felt like it was my duty. It was a duty for me to take care of her. But she was in constant pain. And so when it got to the point where she needed constant medication and so on, we had to make that decision to put her in the hospital. And when she was younger, she just did so many things and was... And for instance, she... See, my mother and I were very, very close. When I got married, I was pregnant. And my mother... She was just so open about it and supportive, and she took me to the doctor. She talked to me a lot. As the pregnancy went along, she came over and helped me do things when I got tired. She just took really, really good care of me. If I had it to do over, I don't think I would have put her in the hospital if I could have helped it. I would have done anything to have 24-hour care at our house. But without somebody's help, Arlene or my dad helping, there was just no way we could do that. And I hope that Arlene understands that, and I hope my father understands that.
Well, it was an unceremonious affair. I'd gotten a lot of admissions, hadn't paid much attention to her just because she was on autopilot, so to speak. All her drips were dripping at the appropriate rate of concentration of drug, and her ventilator was already on maximal settings and couldn't go up any higher anyway, so her pressors were on maximal settings. She was developing gangrene of her fingers and toes because there was no blood to them. Sort of mummified, dry gangrene. And there wasn't anything else could be done. And not even little things. Her heart just finally failed altogether. Couldn't keep up a cardiac output enough to even supply itself, and began having arrhythmias, and finally, after about 5 minutes of arrhythmias, just stopped altogether. She had no more pulse, turned off the ventilator, and that was it. She rolled her down to the morgue, put it in a plastic bag, and it goes into a refrigerator. And then the decision comes to whether or not an autopsy can be done or not.
Last time I saw my mother was about Christmas time a couple of years ago. I came back. She was okay then. And I really came back with the intention of making good with her. I wanted to straighten out some things. But it didn't work. We just, for some reason, we just could not communicate. I don't know. We just... She's very careful about things. She, I'm not sure how I can express myself. I'm here in my mom's house, and she's not around anymore, and there'll be people coming over, and, you know, condolences and all that sort of thing, and I'm looking around for this punch bowl that mom had, well, maybe Margaret borrowed it for some function of hers, but she should have brought it back, and I can't find it. And I know exactly where Mom kept it. I mean, it's like there's this big empty space, and it makes me think that Margaret has been rummaging through here and has already taken things before I even had a chance to get back here. I mean, she's already decided what's hers and what's, you know, what isn't going to be mine, which irritates me.
Tools of an autopsy are really very basic. Scalpel, clamps, forceps, and the real critical thing is really your own eyes and your sense of touch. As the actual definition, the origin of the word was to see for oneself. So in this room we have two stainless steel tables that the body is placed on, and the standard for most autopsies is to make a Y-shaped incision. The incision is made with a scalpel starting at the point of each shoulder, going to the midpoint of the chest, and then down from the abdomen. The chest and abdominal cavities are then opened, and the individual organs are then looked at.
So we wheeled her into the morgue and opened her up and immediately found masses of tumor involving every abdominal organ extensively, liver and kidneys and even kidneys and adrenals and all over her, studying her peritoneal cavity, and got into her chest cavity and found that she did indeed have masses of tumor involving both lungs, but that probably didn't kill her. And she did indeed have pneumonia, but it was patchy and minimal, and that probably didn't kill her. But we did find that she had massive pulmonary emboli in her pulmonary arteries, main pulmonary arteries bilaterally, which is lethal. So we took out samples of the organs and fixed them in special fixatives and put them in, you know, special treatments, and took small sections and stained them and looked at them under the microscope, and took other sections and did other kinds of stains and looked at them under the electron microscope, and defined the best we could all her states of illness, and then wrote it in this document and filed it away.
Ruth was a what I would call a typical old South lady who went to a fine boarding school down here and one of the nicer colleges in the South. And most of the women, I would say, from her background and upbringing, were somewhat content to join the local clubs and raise the family. But Ruth was very torn between whether she really wanted a career or she wanted to be a housewife. I think this caused her quite a few problems, and I wouldn't want to get into the reasons why we separated, but that probably had something to do with that. Of course, I'm mighty upset about this news. You know, Ruth and I was married. We were married long, about 20 years, and that's a long time to stay with a person. And obviously, you gotta be a little upset when something happens to them. And I always wish her the best.
When we get her remains in, we place it on the embalming table. Take all the clothing off of it and wash it down so that it is clean. Then the features are set, such as the facial features, the eyes, the mouth are closed. We have what they call an eye cap. It's a little plastic dome that fits under the eyelid that keeps the eyelid closed. We have a situation such as that that keeps the mouth closed, so that the lips will not part after death, because after death the tissues dehydrate somewhat and will start to shrink. And if we don't have some method to control this, then they will part before the casket is closed and renders an unsightly condition. And after all this is taken care of, then we actually begin the embalming process. And the two vessels that we use are laying side by side, just directly under the skin. The vein is known as the jugular vein. The artery is the carotid artery, which we can inject both up into the head and down into the main body of the individual from that point. We make a small incision, pick up these two vessels, open them. The injection tube from the embalming machine goes into the artery. We open the vein for drainage. Upon that point, we start our machine, and it forces the embalming fluid through the circulatory system in the body, replacing the blood with formaldehyde. And then we use what we call a trocar, which is a oversized needle about a quarter of an inch in diameter, about 18 inches long. We perforate all the intestines, the organs, the cavities, and suck out all the fluids and waste material that happened to be in there. After we get that all cleaned out, then we put in what we call cavity fluid. This is circulated all through the cavities, which preserves the cavity itself. This will conclude the normal embalming process.
Let us pray. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me.
My mother loved to dance with my father, and she was a very trim woman, and she was able to wear very tailored suits very well. But it was neat, she had blue eyes and dark hair, and her eyes would sparkle and sparkle, or if she was angry, they could just sear you, you know, with their iciness. And she was always very tailored, she was terribly well-dressed. I just loved to see them together like that. At least there was a time in their lives when they were very, very happy with each other, and I like to hold on to that.
The belief that Ruth now is where all things are new, where she's at one with God and united with those who have gone before her. Certainly that's the great promise of our Lord when he said, "Where I am, there ye shall be also."
But I also somehow her perspective and her attitudes about life, about people, were so narrow-minded that we can never meet on a common ground. I mean, not that one of us was right or one of us was wrong. It's just that there was no happy meeting. There was just. I don't know. All I know is that we never got it together.
On the qualities of character, the soul qualities that Ruth possessed, her goodness of heart, the friendly spirit that moved in this world with ease and with graciousness, her pride and her skill and her knowledge.
We took the train on a honeymoon, went down to Nassau. Of course, no train running over to Nassau, but we took a train down to Florida and got a plane over there to one of them islands over there. And then we did a whole lot of traveling, went to New York and New Orleans. And, of course, a lot of that was business travel. And Ruth enjoyed those trips. She liked plants, too. She collected house plants. And that was it. One thing, I didn't care much about these trips because I always have to bring back about 8 plants when we come back. And sometimes when you got a small room in the train, it got sort of full.
Only in the physical sense. And so now I ask you to join with me in a prayer of thanksgiving to God that he has given Ruth life to us for, lo, these past 65 years. Let us pray.
She had this charm bracelet I was trying to find. And it was gold, and it had all little trinkets from places that she'd been and things that she'd done. There was this little gold, 14-karat gold lobster from like New Orleans, and I can't find that bracelet. I can't find that bracelet.
We praise thee that through the life, death, and resurrection of thy Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, that has brought life and immortality to light. And we thank thee for the life of the one who has been called away from this earthly existence into thy eternal home.
Toward the end, though, she became more lonely, more and more lonely, withdrawn from the world, she lost her verve, her joy of living. She was sick, and in great pain, I suppose, but bitter mostly. She felt that life was just too much for her, had been too much for her. Her daughter is gone. Just bitter, sad, lonely, and bitter.
Having fought the good fight, having finished her course, and having kept the faith, wilt thou grant unto her the crown of life that fadeth not away? We pray for those whom she leaves behind, for her family and her friends.
I'm just sort of leading a quiet life down here in Charleston, and don't know whether I'm going to be able to get out to Salt Lake City, though, or not here the next day or two. I'd like to. Got a right big board meeting coming up here tomorrow, and it's been planned for about 6 months, and I've got my girl here in the office trying to call some of the folks to see if we can rearrange it, but I just don't know yet. Sort of don't like to fly much either, and that makes the time sort of hard to get out there quickly. All right, well, if you don't mind here, hold on just a second. I think, hold on just a second here now. Miss Llewellyn, who? Okay. Miss Llewellyn said I got a call coming in here from Miami. If you don't mind holding just a second, I'll be right back with you.
And now may that peace which passeth all understanding be and abide in this place for this day and forevermore. World without end. Amen.
We are going about almost 55 inches deep right now. The machine go in there, and he take one bite out of that grave, and I think sometime, boy, that take me a long time to do that by hand. See, besides digging graves, we also cut grass, water the grass, trimming around the headstones. You know, winter we have snow to shovel, path to clear, area to clean for the people to stand. And you see that you bury the people and you say they're dead, and yet don't we believe into a resurrection? And that's the same with the trees in the spring. Those trees are just like a resurrected being. They're coming out and bud, and later on the leaves come out, and then of course the flowers come out, and with it the birds. The wonderful birds we got in here in the cemetery. Weather, oh, I saw some bad weather here. I've been sending out here in snowstorms, in big thunderstorms, in lightning storms, and yet if the sun come out and everything is beautiful and it smells so good, it is a wonderful the beer. It feels real good. I like it.
The Death of Ruth Tuck, produced by Scott Carrier and Ken Larson for New American Radio in 1986. Full disclosure, most of the voices were actors improvising. This is Hearing Voices.
And Ben Brooks and Lester and Charlotte Lou. We're all here having a little afternoon tea, and we wanted to talk to you, but I guess you're up. We want to know how Ralph is. Would you try to call us back one day and let us know what's going on? We all want to know how Ralph is doing. We hope he's doing well. Let us know. Bye.
Mr. Golding, this is Dr. Sparks' office confirming your appointment for Tuesday, July 12th at 4 o'clock. You don't need to call us unless there's a problem. Thank you.
Hi, this is Rose Bernstein. Just calling to welcome you back and hope you had a very good time. And we'd like to say hi to you. Bye-bye.
Claire, I'm just heartsick over what happened. I'll get in touch with you later. And then.
Hi, Mrs. Golding. It's Liz calling from Dr. Casey's office. I wanted just to give you my condolences and tell you how sorry I am. I think we should touch bases at some point, and I'll try calling you again later today. Bye.
Claire, it's 12:30. I just got a call in reference to Ralph's. Please give me a call whenever you can. Thank you.
Bye.
So give me a call.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Mr. Golding?
Bye-bye.
I wanted to give
you
my condolences and tell you how sorry I am.
Claire, I'm just heartsick over what happened. I'll get in touch with you later.
Those were messages found on my mom's answering machine after my dad died. I miss him. The music is by Skyward. I'm Barrett Golding, and there's links to everything you heard at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.